Aisha, and I'm a former host of Mocha Single Mothers by Choice, or SMCs. Like you, as an SMC, I decided to become a mother knowing I'd be the sole care provider and parent for my children, at least at the outset. The Mocha stood for Black, so I'm using the word Black, and I'll be discussing being a single mother by choice from a Black woman's lens. You'll connect with all the interesting and fun things about this non-traditional path, like discussing which sperm to use and some hard truths about fertility and the realities of dating as a single mother who doesn't have a co-parent to rely on occasionally, and what it's actually like to parent as an S&C. This is the Black Single Mothers by Choice podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kimberly. I am from New York. I have a daughter via IVF. She's going to be 2 in 3 months. She's 21 months old now, and her name is Meridian. It was a road to birthing her and bringing her into the world, but it's been great. I work at a high school as a teaching assistant in special education, and I'm currently a full-time grad student studying public health, specifically interested in maternal and reproductive health from my experiences leading to motherhood.
So let's dive in. Tell us a little bit about your story and what led you to the S&C path.
I actually have thought about it a lot since I started joining SMC groups. When was that shift that I was like, okay with having a kid by myself? And it's for as long as I can remember. I've always been fine with when other people are making pacts, like if we're not married by this, we're going to marry each other. I'm sure I like engaged with conversation about those. But I was always just like, if I don't have a kid by 30, I'm just going to start doing what I got to do to have a kid on my own. And that's just always been the way that I viewed it. And there just became a point where I was dating to look for someone to have a kid with. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? I want the family more than the partner. So let's just make the family. Right. So that's what, it just was a natural progression for me. When I turned 30, I was like, you know what? I am ready to go ahead and start. So I went through that year. I enjoyed the job I was at for that year. And then when I turned 31, I went on a long solo travel trip just to get that out. And then I came back and I started the process.
Yeah,
I definitely realized I was like, this isn't what I...
Because I think the reality hits, like, you're like, I could do this. I can have him in my life forever. But then the reality hits when you think about that child is totally innocent. And then I know for me, I had a passing thought. What if this doesn't work? What if this person is dating someone who's
ratchet as F?
and you're just like, no. And then you really can't say no, because that other person legally has rights to the kid, and you have to come to terms with being okay with not having that degree of control. And some things work out for the good, and some things people are strange, and you have an innocent little nonverbal few month old.
So it's terrible to say, I actually just didn't even think about what people would think about me being a single mom, because there are a lot of things that have stigmatized me through my life. I don't consider myself heavily tattooed because I did work in the industry with people who are heavily tattooed, but I'm considered heavily tattooed for working in schools, and I've had a lot of piercings and colorful hair. So there's always just been people that are going to look at me however they want, and I've just frankly never cared. After my daughter was born, the only way in which I've thought about it is how it would impact her and the way people treat her. Mm-hmm. But families are just diverse at this point, that I feel like at the point where it may be more of an issue for her, there are just going to be so many examples I can point her to say, look at this different family structure, look at that different family structure, that me being a solo mom and it being my choice isn't going to be as crazy as... I just never really worried about how people are going to view me. The only time I started thinking about it is how people are going to treat my daughter. As for me, I'm just like, I don't really care what people think about me. I'm always ready to pull out the, are we going to do the comparison, the keeping up with the Joneses? Because I'm sure there's plenty of things you've done in your life that I'm not trying to do. And there's plenty of things I've done in my life that you're not trying to do. Yeah. I've always been fine going on dates by myself, going to movies by myself, traveling by myself. So these were always things that people were like, you're going to do that by yourself. So when it came to becoming a mother by myself, I feel like everybody was so desensitized by my personality on issue, because I just remember when I decided to do it, there was never that conversation where anyone pulled me aside. No one in my actual circle pulled me aside. Right. And was like, are you sure? Because they were just like, oh, that's just Kim. And all of my best friend's parents were like, yeah, that's Kim.
Mm-hmm, that's great.
Because I am queer, even though I've dominantly dated men in my life, I'm not solely attracted to men. So there was always the possibility that I would have needed to do fertility treatment. So it was always something I was open to. And I've just never solidly been able to envision what my future would be. I've never really dreamed about what a proposal would be like. The only part of my wedding I ever think about is the party. Like,
what? Awesome. I'm so serious.
For me, the cake. Yep. For me, the cake.
Party, swag surf, like that. That's what I've always thought about. So I didn't. So based on my age, I hoped it would be easier than I was preparing for. So I started at 31, but at 27, I'd had a major fibroid removal surgery. There's a lot of different ways you can get fibroids removed. And the most severe is to have a vertical incision done to remove the fibroids in an open surgery. And that's what I needed, because I had what the post-surgical notes listed as a basketball-sized tumor, and then some others that were removed. So it was about 9 pounds of tumors. I had to have my intestines repaired during the surgery. So I'd had this major surgery. I knew I had a bunch of scarring in my uterus. My doctor was monitoring me pretty frequently for new growths. And within 6 months, I had new fibroids. I knew going in, my doctor that I have now, it was her father that was the lead on my surgery. And he told me, he was very honest. He said, you have about 5 years before I predict that you would need another myomectomy, because that kind of aggressive growth in somebody in their mid-20s is going to happen again. Like, it's likely to happen again. So I had already decided 30. So I was like, that's fine. Let's do this.
You're like, I'm good.
But, so I didn't expect it to be the easiest to carry, but I really hoped that the getting pregnant part would be pretty straightforward. So I started with medicated IUIs because I was like, let me not go super invasive because I might be lucky. And three medicated IUIs failed. And I said, give me my diagnosis of infertility. I'm ready to move on to IVF, because I did my research and I knew three was all I was willing to do, but I was prepared for the off chance that it would be difficult, because I don't take anything for granted with fertility. Like, it's not as easy as everyone acts like.
No.
So let's take a step back for a little bit. In SMC spaces, a lot of times we get the question, how many of you got pregnant on your first IUI or your first IVF? And I know internally I cringe, because I know where they are coming from. They are thinking, I just got up the nerve to do this. Mm-hmm. I told my people I want it to be done and done. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear people say that,
don't want to be the negative Nancy. I don't want to be that person, but I just think we spend so much time focused on not getting pregnant that we're set up to assume that it's going to be easy to get pregnant. I had it in my mind that it wouldn't necessarily be, when I changed a few things in my life to prepare for the possibility. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because I remember being disappointed by my first failure, but not surprised, because I was like, it's not a given. And knowing your exact window of conception adds to it, because I am that person that's like, okay, if I got pregnant this time, let me go to the due date calculator and see when this baby's born, when you know.
And then with each failure, you can hear the cash register ching, because especially if you're paying out of pocket, and especially if you are trying to build money as you go, it's just, okay, so I did this IUI, please let it work, please let it work. And then if it doesn't work, how long you wait between that IUI and the next one is dependent on your reserves, right? Your cash reserves, or you are looking at the uptick of debt. And so there is a whole psychological aspect where, yeah, you do want it to work the first time, but you also really want it to work because you're not sure if you can afford the next time. And so, yeah, very real concerns.
I had actually done some prepping just in case. So I left the job that I had for a few reasons. One was I found it very important to be near doctors that I trusted. the lead on my surgery was my current doctor's father. She became my doctor after, and I've been with her ever since. And she's always really listened to me. If I said I wanted to do a check in 4 months to check for fibroids, that's what she signed me up for. There was never an argument. There were always just very honest conversations between us. Mm-hmm. So I was always like, it's very important for me to be near her. That was one reason. I was working in New York City and she's in Long Island, so I came back to Long Island. The second reason was that I knew working for the education system, like the public school education system, I would have insurance that would cover a lot in the realm of fertility. So I started before my insurance took effect, but I had left my job. I took a pretty significant pay cut. I moved back home because I was like, just in case, let me have this insurance in place. And there's still out-of-pocket costs. I still had to pay for the donor sperm, the shipping, the thawing, the co-pays for medication. But the impact wasn't as massive. And like over time, over my getting pregnant and pregnancy, I made that pay cut 10 times over because I did not have an easy time. So I was pretty terrible about regularly going to the gynecologist. Like, you know, I would go every so often, but you know, in college, you could get tested without going to the gynecologist. You could get things. And I never went on birth control because I always knew that like I wanted a baby. So I just never went on birth control, practice other forms of safe sex or whatever. So I was lucky, I guess. I was asymptomatic for my first surgery. No idea. The only reason I went to the doctor was because I had a coworker who was pregnant at the time. And I felt this like solid mass in my abdomen. And we were joking that my stomach felt like her stomach. And I was like, it's getting a little weird that my stomach's so hard and it's not going away. I thought it was gas, tried stuff for gas, like didn't work. Went to a doctor and he was like, are you positive you're not pregnant? And I was like, I'm absolutely positive. Made me take a pregnancy test. And he was like, you need to go to the hospital and get an MRI. Got the MRI. And this is actually what kind of started my path in thinking about going back to school. Well, when I decided to go back to school, this was the start to it. I went to the hospital and went to the emergency room, had speculum after speculum put in me because everyone was like, yo, we can't see anything past your cervix. And when the results came back, I had fibroids, and it was just very casually. They said, oh, just go to your gynecologist. It can be handled as an outpatient. Tons of women have fibroids. Here's some paperwork. Goodbye. So that's I take crazy. The paperwork and I'm like reading, and the one they put on the top is this percentage of women have fibroids. They're benign tumors, blah, blah, blah. So I start going through my actual report and it says that I had degeneration, which is when your fibroids lose blood supply, they start dying off. And it can appear that you might have a uterine sarcoma in MRIs when you have that. So there was a little blurb about a uterine sarcoma in there. And I was like,
oh, geez.
Wait a second. And then I started Googling the measurements for the fibroids I had. The largest was 23 centimeters was the mass that they saw. So I'm Googling, not finding comparisons because everyone has the fruit chart comparisons. Mm-hmm. Not really finding it. Build a real life model of the dimensions that they said it was. It was wild. So I started calling gynecologist office like crazy to find who could see me as soon as possible, because I was like, this doesn't sound normal. I got lucky. A few days later, I saw, actually funny enough, it was the gynecologist that delivered my younger siblings. And she immediately was like, I'm going to send you to who I would go to if I needed surgery. And that's how I ended up with the doctor I'm at now, because it was very odd because the hospital was just like, so many women have these, it's fine.
I was like, so I do have two questions, right? So I know as one of the methods for removing really large fibroids is possibly a hysterectomy. And I actually had a friend who was in her mid-30s. And so at the time, she was lamenting about how she wanted children. And then I was just like, yeah, you can have children, just off the top of my head. And she's just like, no, I had a hysterectomy. And I was like, whoa. And I was like, a hysterectomy. So she's in her early 30s. So that meant that she had to have had a hysterectomy like in her 20s. And so it's just like, so that is her story. My story was at the time that I wanted to try to conceive, I also was discovered to have a small fibroid. So they had to remove my fibroid. And so one of the things, I was glad that I had my fertility specialist remove my fibroid, because it's almost as if you have to tell people, I would like to have children one day. So preserve my fertility. Did you have that conversation with your doctors, or did they automatically assume that our first course of action is to preserve fertility as we remove this fibroid?
So I was lucky. I do say I was lucky because not everyone has the experience of stumbling into doctors who guide them the way that mine did. So the first woman I went to, as I said she couldn't see much. But based on my MRI results, she really felt like I should go to an oncologist, like a gynecological oncologist. So I went to him and he was very clear with me. He said, if it is a sarcoma, there's just no discussion. Like you will still have your ovaries. It will still be possible to have a biological child, but there's no discussion. And he asked me clearly, he said, do you want children? He said, absolutely. He said, I'm going to speak to you a little bit about what things will be like moving forward for you with such an aggressive growth so young. He's like, let me just be honest. You will likely need another surgery in the future if you don't have a kid sooner rather than later. And gave me the whole speech. But he said, if having a kid is what you want, I will do everything that I can to preserve your uterus. I did have to sign for a hysterectomy just because it didn't look good. That large fibroid was just one of four. And the scans just didn't look good. And like I said, they went in and had to repair my bowel and things like that. So they've really put in the work to preserve my fertility. And that was one of the reasons that I stayed with them moving forward. And I was lucky because some people get a myomectomy, which is the surgery that you remove fibroids with, and their doctor's like, okay, we'll do a post-op and then I'll see you yearly. But my doctor was like, let's do every 3 months for the year after the surgery. Then we moved to every 6 months. Like she wanted to keep up with my growth. And we mutually decided when we said, okay, we're basically at the time where if I start now, I might be able to have a kid before I need another surgery. So I've just been very lucky to have been able to stay with doctors who discuss things with me and listen to me and really put preserving my fertility and ability to carry a child first. And they've always been clear that, and I, another lucky thing, they've always been clear there are other ways to have a biological child, even if you can't carry, but they knew that was something that I wanted.
Kim, so let's talk about, okay, so now you get your fibroid removed and now you're on the path to trying to conceive as an SMC. And so I think it's important to have the conversation about what do you do? What's your mindset when things don't necessarily go as planned, right? Because I don't think most people come to the SMC path like, oh, I'm going to prepare myself for if this doesn't, you know, work, if I have to work with alternative options, right? So we're thinking like, yes, I am going to go on this SMC path. And that's the hardest thing that I'm going to have to do, have the conversation with my family. But I think all of us on this conversation know that there are just life happens that is unexpected. And when you're doing this alone or without a partner, it can almost be like double the burden, double the pain, double the hurt, because it's just you. So can you talk us through that a little bit and then talk about what your support system looked like?
As I said, I didn't necessarily expect it to work right away, but I also didn't expect to need to move on to IVF. So I was in this gray area where I hoped IUI would work. It's medicated. I'm increasing my chances. I know there's a problem with my uterus. I just didn't expect it not to work. And I am very much a contingency person. So if this doesn't work, what is my next course of action? So when the first one didn't work, I knew automatically I was going right into a second. When the second didn't work, I knew that I would go to a third because I had read three is once you do three, your chances aren't getting any better after that. It's just like a numbers game. Maybe eventually you'll get pregnant. So I knew that was the limit for me. Going into my third cycle, I got a rapid cyst growth. It was canceled. So then again, I was like, another pushback. But I just kept very much always looking forward. This is what I'm willing to do. And I know these are the steps I'm willing to take. So for me, it was just I think the biggest thing with moving to IVF was that I knew it was more invasive and more of a commitment. As much as I considered for a hot second, maybe I'll just do one more IUI, I knew that I also didn't want to waste time. So going through it by myself, it's not that I'm not an emotional person, because I am at times, but I can be very much a logic-based person and very much removed emotionally from things sometimes. Sometimes I just had to step back and I was like, Kim, don't get too involved with your emotions. Focus on what your next move or your next plan is. That doesn't mean I didn't grieve when I needed to grieve, but I didn't like to let the grieving process of something not working overtake what I was focused on doing and planning to do. It was just move forward until it happened. My support system is always interesting because I have parents who they let me move back in to my house. I was going to come back and rent with my friends again, but my parents were closer to my job and my clinic. So they were like, come back home. We don't want you alone for the process. But I've also been a person that reaches out or leans on people a ton. So it was, they knew I was doing it. My parents aren't like the people I really go to for that. So it's great. Definitely. So I've always had a really great circle of friends and I love my friends to death. They're the family that I've built alongside my blood family. So I had my circle of best friends who were involved in every step, hyping me up when I chose a donor. They're like the hype crew all the way. So like one of my best friends was like at a casino one day before my first transfer and was like, boom, Apple paid you some money toward the donor. Like Apple paid me half her winnings because she's like, I want in on the baby. Yes. My circle of friends were great. I was dating someone at the time that I'd been with for years. The reason we always worked was we're both very logic-based people. So we met and we were just trying to hang and bang and ended up dating. We ended up dating, but we were both very clear from the beginning. I was like, I'm having a baby. So that's that. And he was like, I don't know if that's what I want. And I was like, I don't need you to want that. That's fine. Mm-hmm. He was in my support circle. He's very much like, science is there. So all you have to do is keep going. Mm-hmm. And so in my circle of friends, it was just great. Like I rarely ever asked for rides anywhere, but when I needed a ride, they were like, all right, I got you. What do we need to do? What do you need from us? And to this day, they're still that way through my wild pregnancy. Since I've had my daughter, my circle has just been phenomenal. It's my best friends. They're just really chill people. Like I just always wish when I see in groups that people are having trouble with people accepting it or having trouble keeping friendships when they become parents, I'm like, I just always wish I could give them all like my circle because they're so like, they're amazing. That's awesome. I'm lucky. Honestly, I really love the newborn phase because the thing was, I always heard like the newborn phase was like, you'll never sleep. You'll be so exhausted.
It so depends on the kid.
So they're like, oh, this, then third. And I was just like, the newborn phase was so chill because I've never been a good sleeper. So it was like, oh, cool. You want to eat now? Let's do this. And so it was chill because they sleep a lot.
Yeah.
You feed them and then they start becoming interested in other things. And that's when things change. They become mobile and then they start climbing and then they become very curious. So for me, I always think back so fondly on the newborn stage because I'm like, we were just chilling.
I knew where you were. You weren't jumping in the pool. Yeah, you weren't eating sand.
Here. So it's like the newborn phase is like, ooh, but like you said, it does depend on the child because my daughter, the first visit to the pediatrician, he was like, yeah, if I had my second kid first, there never would have been two. I always joke that Meridian and I just vibed really well. We had hard, like she was in the NICU. So I also feel there was, she was out. I guess people call attachment parenting, co-sleep. I didn't nurse her, but I did breastfeed. I pumped and fed her. And a lot of it had to do with that time that I couldn't touch her and that I couldn't physically be close to her. So my pregnancy physically, I felt great. I actually felt like I wasn't pregnant for a lot of my pregnancy. I didn't have morning sickness. I did get like motion sickness when I would fly, which I'd never had before. But other than that, it was pretty chill, but it kept me on alert all the time because it was just like, don't feel
is everything
things.
Okay?
Like, yeah. Is everything okay? And then I had a pretty significant issue in my pregnancy that compounded with another issue. And they were like, together, your prognosis is very low. So from there, my pregnancy was a lot of time spent in doctor's offices, a lot of time spent getting tests and sonograms. And then I ended up in the hospital at 26 weeks because on top of it all, my water broke early. And I was lucky I stayed for another month. And at 30 weeks, I gave birth to Meridian. 30 weeks for a preemie isn't the worst. They're usually pretty developed. But my biggest issue was that I didn't really have amniotic fluid. So her lungs just never got to develop. from 19 weeks on. So she was intubated and I wasn't able to hold her. I wasn't able to do anything like that for the first 11 days of her life. It was, I actually didn't even see her when she was born because they took her immediately. So I saw her, I had her at 4:30 and saw her at 1.
Okay.
And so for me, it was just like, give me like
skin to skin, all full skin to skin.
They were like, Miss Mitchell lives in the NICU. We don't take care of her baby. She takes care of her baby.
Yeah.
They were like, skin to skin is good for the breathing. So I was like, all right.
Yes. It's like skin to skin. Let's peel it all off. Make a skin blanket. Yes.
She's an appendage. Like,
So Kim, if you were to give any advice to SNCs coming up, thinkers, people at the beginning of trying, what bit of advice would you give them?
I would say, forget about your high school health classes. I've gotten into many a debate with coworkers about health classes.
They barely scratch the surface.
About your high school health classes, because you don't know. And I would definitely say a lot of thinkers hesitate to even start anything in the process. My biggest advice would be to go ahead and do the initial consult because you never know what you're going to find out in that consult. I was lucky that I already had surgery and I knew what was going on with my fibroids.
Right.
But if you haven't had a reason to look, a lot of people never find out until they're pregnant that they have fibroids or that they have, till they're trying that they have issues. So my biggest advice would be go ahead and do the consult, even if you don't plan to start everything else right away.
Yeah.
And then my other would be, there's nothing wrong with a plan A, B. Like, you have your plan A, there's nothing wrong with having a plan B in the back of your mind, because everything is just one step of a much longer process per second. And it's literally just, so I've done 6 transfers and unfortunately still not pregnant. I had my 3rd myomectomy, so my 3rd fibroid removal recently. And I actually did go into this one thinking that I would definitely get pregnant from one of the 4 frozen embryos I had left. And I didn't. And I had to do another egg retrieval, the whole 9. And a lot of people that have experienced fertility treatments are like, I feel for you, the pregnancy will happen. You just got to keep going. But I'm like, pregnancy is just one step. So the consult's just one step. Getting your medication is just one step. So everything is one step towards such a much longer journey. So just do the steps you can until you're ready for the next step. Because waiting for everything, there's rarely ever a perfect time that everything comes together, honestly. Thank you for this. Honestly, I randomly was introduced to the space because I started joining spaces very late after I had my daughter. I think she was over a year. When I joined this space, the rest slowly just filtered out as unnecessary for me because the connections are very different in this space. And what y'all bring to the space is definitely felt. And it's, I'm just a person that honestly is genuinely happy for people getting pregnant. I'm like the hype team. I am the hype team. I love the space because there's just a good vibe. There's a good feeling. I am always excited to interact with people from the space because it's so weird. Black women are such survivors, and yet we're just not cared for in the right way in the health field, especially maternal and reproductive health. And the way that we like care for each other in that space is so significant to me. And that's going back to school. I'm like, this is why I do it. Cause I see the women in that space, and when they're having trouble medically with their doctors or this or that, I'm like, this is why I'm going back to school, because we need advocates, and you guys opening that space and creating it is advocacy for us. It's empowering us. It's giving us what we need and introducing us to people that we may never have interacted with, who have advice that we all need to hear. I definitely am thankful for you guys. And I'm so happy I found it.
We appreciate the contributions you make to the space. It takes us all. And it's these journeys, these stories are not just stories, right? We become invested in each other. We become invested in each other's kids. And we are just like rooting both silently and vocally. And the space is just super, super important. And to keep it safe, to keep it open, to keep it inclusive. And thank you for sharing your story, because the joy that you bring, and I feel that joy And it's like sometimes from the hardest journeys just comes that gratitude. It's like you've stolen joy and nobody can take it away. And it's just such a magical feeling.
I'm very lucky to be Meridian's mama. I always tell her that. I'm like, thank you. You're wild.
But I still love you. Oh,
but that's my little heart running all over the place and jumping and diving.
Yeah. Thank you, Kim, for joining us and talking to us.
Thank you.
Well, Pod, thank you so much for taking the time to listen. If you like what you've heard, please share this podcast with your girlfriends, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about the topics covered in this episode. So email me at mochasnc@gmail.com. If you found value in the topics covered, consider making a donation using the link in the show notes below. Till next time, Pod. Bye now.